You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Depending on who you've been reading, over the past year, Treasury Secretary Timothy Geithner has been kowtowing to Wall Street's interests, or he's been taking steps towards socializing our economy. Either way, Mr. Geithner is unpopular with many Americans these days. Joining me now to assess his first 15 months in office are John Cassidy, a staff writer for The New Yorker. His article on Secretary Geithner appears in the March 15th issue of the magazine. And welcome back to our show, John.
Thanks for inviting me on, Leonard.
Also with us is Joshua Green, whose profile of Mr. Geithner appears in the April issue of The Atlantic. Welcome to our show.
Good to be with you guys.
We've been seeing a lot of profiles of Timothy Geithner recently. Is that because the recession has technically ended and there have been a few positive economic numbers, or is this just a natural time to assess how he's done? Josh?
Well, I started working on mine last fall when it wasn't such a popular thing to write about, so I'm not quite sure why they're all appearing at once. But you know, I think that any good journalist sort of takes a look at what's going on behind the scenes. And in the case of Geithner, I think what the administration has done in terms of economic policy, John's article pointed this out also, I think they actually have a really good story to tell that a lot of people in the public don't realize, that there have been some considerable successes along with the failures that we see in the headlines day after day.
Well, it's a little over a year, and I would assume, John, that people start thinking about, well, how well has he done after 12 months or so?
Right. Well, that was certainly the peg for my article. I mean, he launched his financial stabilization plan this time last year, actually in February of last year. And 12 months is obviously a natural time to take a look at it. I mean, the thing about Geithner, he's such a controversial figure because he's also involved in the prior bailout. That's what people get mixed up. You know, he was involved in the original bailout under Bush with Paulson and the AIG bailout. So he came into office with an incredible amount of baggage. But I think people don't then look at what he's done under Obama and separate that from his previous incarnation.
Well, have either of you thoughts about why Obama named him to the post, considering the fact that he had been with Bush? Wouldn't it have been a lot easier for Obama to simply bring in somebody else and be able to blame everybody who had worked for Bush for all the problems?
I think you have to remember at the time that the economy was still in free fall. There was an economic crisis. People were scared. You had a young and not very experienced president coming in. And what people most wanted, I think, was continuity. And Geithner, despite the fact that he'd worked, I guess arguably in the Bush administration, not really in a political job, but he really represented continuity and reassurance. And I think that that was what was so valuable about him as a candidate initially. But I also think it's become a problem for exactly the reason that John mentioned, which is that he's so closely associated with a lot of these unpopular bailouts that he winds up implicating the Obama administration in them, unfairly, I think.
John, were there other serious contenders for the job?
Well, there were some people on Wall Street who'd raised a lot of money for Obama, who people looked at, things like Roger Altman, who's an well-known investment banker. His name was kicking around. Various other names, Steve Rattner, who also has raised a lot of money. But I think the key thing at the time was, you know, the economy was in crisis. We just had these enormous bank failures in the fall of 2008. And Obama took a strategic decision to sort of stick with the approach that the Bush administration had adopted, which, although incredibly unpopular politically, did stabilize the situation. So I think it was a sort of responsible decision on Obama's part, but politically it's completely backfired on him, as Josh says, because nobody distinguishes between the two. And actually, somebody told me when I was writing this piece that the Obama administration has done internal polling, which shows that most people think the $787 billion bailout, I mean, sorry, I made the same mistake there, the $787 billion stimulus package went to the banks, when in fact none of that went to the banks, of course. So it's all mushed together in people's minds.
And many people don't remember that the whole thing started with President Bush. They associated totally with the Obama administration.
Totally right. I mean, I think the key political problem here is that because you've got Geithner in there and because you've got Summers in there, who was associated with the Clinton administration's deregulation policies, the president can't do what you had suggested and run against the previous administration all the time, which is exactly what Reagan did in the early 80s during a recession. He blamed it all on Carter and spent the first 3 years running against Jimmy Carter, and it worked quite successfully. By putting these guys in office, Obama sort of ruled that out.
At the beginning of this segment, I summarized the main schools of criticism of Senator Geithner's performance. I'm assuming they're more nuanced than that. Secretary Geithner. Did I say Senator Geithner?
Yeah, well, at least he didn't say he works for Goldman Sachs, which is the mistake that most people make.
Well, almost everybody else has.
Yeah.
Has he done much to socialize the economy?
I don't think he has. I mean, one big theme in my piece, and John gets at this also, is the idea that the government has somehow kind of, you know, taken over the private markets. I mean, if you look at what Geithner actually did with this, with his plan, I think it's involved the government sort of as little as was feasible rather than as much as was feasible. I mean, the debate back at the time, you know, Geithner was kind of first unveiled as Treasury Secretary was, should the government nationalize, you know, all these ailing banks? The expectation, especially sort of in the kind of left elite economic circles, was beginning to drift toward the idea that this was sort of an unpopular but possibly a necessary thing to do. And instead, by coming up with various plans that he has and the government and the Fed have imposed, that hasn't been necessary. So the government is much less involved in that sense than they might otherwise have been. And yet that's not a message that most Americans have received.
Well, some economists, including Joseph Stiglitz, are arguing that nationalizing the banks would have been wiser. John, why is nationalization seen as a policy of last resort, considering the fact that so many other countries, including Norway, Sweden, the U.K., all have nationalized their banks?
I mean, I was one of the early people calling for some nationalization and sort of advocating the Swedish model. So I'm not attacking Joe Stiglitz's line on intellectual lines. My argument in the piece is just that Geithner rejected that line for some financial reasons, but also for political reasons. They didn't want to go back to Congress and ask for more money. And that decision he made, whatever you think of it at the time, has turned out better than most people expected. The argument for nationalization was not a sort of socialist one. Some people made a socialist argument. But the main argument was that if you didn't nationalize the banks, like Citigroup, Bank of America, take all these toxic assets off their balance sheet and put them in a so-called bad bank, the financial crisis would just go on and on and on. The government had to step in to sort of end the panic. What Geithner did is said, well, we don't necessarily need to do that. Here's another way of doing it. Let's leave them in the private sector, but hold these stress tests and try and force them to raise private capital from private investors. At the time, lots of people, myself included, were very skeptical of that idea, said it just sounded like window dressing and wouldn't work. Turns out it did work better than most people expected. In fact, it worked so well that the banks are now making a fortune and paying big bonuses, and Geithner gets attacked for that. So economically, the plan worked quite well. Politically, it's rebounded on them.
My guest, so John Cassidy, a staff writer for The New Yorker. His article, No Credit, appears in the March 15th issue of the magazine. Joshua Green, senior editor at The Atlantic. His article, Timothy Geithner, Inside Man, appears in the April issue of that magazine. So what policies have attracted the most criticism, the stimulus or the bank stress tests?
I would say the original bailout is still the big thing. The fact that the banks got all this money from the taxpayer and then turned around when they got healthy again and started paying out big bonuses. Now, Geithner also, you know, this guy's not a very politically adept operator. Maybe he's better now than he used to be. But towards the start of the Obama administration, you'll remember there was this big blow-up about bonuses at AIG. They gave them a bunch of retention bonuses. These were the very guys who'd brought the system down at the AIG Financial Products Department, and they were being given $160 million in bonuses, I think. People in Congress went berserk. There was a bill put forward to tax these bonuses. Some people said the Treasury Secretary should step in. Geithner said, no, we can't do that. This is a legal contract. There's nothing we can do about it. Eventually, Andrew Cuomo, the New York State Attorney General, stepped in and through sort of arm twisting and rhetorical pressure persuaded AIG to give back, or the guys who got the bonuses, to give back about a quarter or a half of them. That was just a terrible political mistake by Geithner, which I think has hung over him for the entire year.
Josh, how has Geithner responded to the criticisms that have been leveled against him?
He's really just sort of sat there and absorbed it for the most part. I mean, if you know, when you talk to him, you get the sense that he's sort of frustrated and exasperated, that he thinks he's kind of had this real big political success that ought to win him praise on the left and on the right. On the right, for not having been as involved in the private market as the government might have been, and on the left, for having contained the financial crisis at a much, much smaller price tag than anyone would have imagined just a year ago. And thereby freed up money for health care reform or climate or whatever liberal goals, you know, the Obama administration wished to pursue. So I think he's sort of frustrated, But I think within the administration, his successes are recognized and valued. And so all this talk about Guyton resigning, I don't put much stock in that.
Well, as you point out, there are some estimates that the course of action could end up costing taxpayers less than the government's response to the savings and loan crisis in the late 1980s and early 1990s. Why hasn't that news had more of an impact on the American public?
That's a very good question, Leonard. I mean, I think part of it is that Guyton's just not a very good communicator. He does say this.
Isn't that part of his job?
It is part of his job.
And does he have PR people?
Well, he actually has reasonable PR people now, but I think it took a long time to get that message out. And people, you know, what happened is that he had this enormous wave of criticism during the summer and the fall, the whole Tea Party movement that was all partly posited on the idea that the Obama administration was giving billions and billions of dollars to the banks. And the Treasury didn't get out this message that actually the banks are paying back some of this money, and eventually most of it is going to be paid back. That doesn't mean that the entire taxpayer is off the hook. I mean, we've spent billions and billions of dollars guaranteeing loans. The federal deficit's gone up enormously because of the stimulus package.
And the unemployment rate is held steady at 9.7.
Exactly. So it's not an overall, you know, it's not time to sort of declare victory here, but just on narrow terms of how much it costs to stabilize the financial system, are the banks repaying the money, the Treasury's got a good story to tell. And it is trying to tell it now, but, you know, it's a little late.
You know, John, I disagree a little bit about the idea that Guyton needs to be the guy to sell this. I mean, if you look back traditionally at Treasury secretaries, a few of them, maybe James Baker, you know, have come out and been able to kind of speak to the public. But to me, it seems like a job for the president to do, for the Obama administration, especially when you know you've got a guy in place like Guyton, who, for all his talents, is sort of a bloodless technocrat when he's standing in front of a microphone. You know, his public debut in February, which John wrote about in his article, was such a disaster. I think the market plunged 400 points the next day. So while it would be nice to have someone that could kind of go out there and sell this plan with some charisma, I tend to fault the Obama administration more broadly for failing to explain to the public about really what they've done and why it isn't nearly as bad as people think it is.
Well, Hank Paulson, who was Guyton's predecessor, had very little or no camera presence during his time in the Bush administration.
Yeah.
So you're saying the Treasury Secretary doesn't have to do that. But it
would be nice if he could. But I think traditionally, Treasury secretaries have not, you know, needed among their assets the ability to go out and be charismatic public speakers. And only because there's sort of a crisis at this depth and magnitude, I think has that need arisen. But to me, as I said, you have the greatest communicator in politics sitting right there in the White House, could do a much, much better job of communicating this than his Treasury Secretary could. And I'm still sort of puzzled even today why President Obama hasn't done a better job of explaining what they're doing.
Yeah, I mean, I totally agree with that. I mean, the thing about Obama is they do wheel him out every now and again to try and give a consistent message on the sort of bank bailout and, you know, attacking the banks. But he's very inconsistent. I mean, he called in Business Week a few weeks ago and gave them an interview, and presumably the reason they did that was to try and, you know, issue a tough message on bank bonuses, etc. But then the president said, well, you know, there's some baseball players who earn $16, $17 million a year and they don't win the World Series. We don't punish them for that. Which, you know, it was a fair point, but it was completely against what the message
was. Not a helpful one, yeah. Well, yeah, I mean, the problem for both of them, for Obama and Guyton, is I don't think either one has a populist bone in his body, and I'm not sure anyone in the administration does. And so they just seem sort of, you know, intellectually out of tune with what so much of the public is feeling. And it's just, you know, sort of devastating to watch again and again and again. Every time AIG issues another round of bonuses, Guyton gets hauled before Congress and beaten up. And, you know, Obama sort of hems and haws, and they just don't seem to be able to handle the kind of public relations aspect, the what we in Washington call the messaging aspect of what they're doing on this scandal. And it's really sort of an odd thing to watch because, as I think both our articles make clear, there are some real positive things that they've done.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, I wasn't writing about this. It's been written about a lot elsewhere. I think there is a serious question underlying it, what Guyton was doing when AIG was bailed out. And, you know, why did Goldman Sachs get paid 100%?
And by the way, you didn't see Michael Lewis, you told me, on 60 Minutes yesterday, but he deals with this, and it can't have help the Obama administration or Timothy Geithner.
No, I think the Obama administration presumably didn't know about this when they appointed him. Just to remind the listeners, AIG got bailed out and immediately gave $13 billion to Goldman Sachs, which they owed him. They paid him at 100% on contracts which were trading in the market at about 13, 14%. Geithner has said that he'd recused himself from this. He was president of the New York Fed at the time, though, and has never really given a convincing explanation of what happened. And it keeps getting brought up. It, you know, every left-wing article mentions it. There's a new congressional hearing about it every couple of months. And, you know, it's just, I'm afraid it'll hang over him till his grave.
We're going to take a little break, and we'll come back with more. By the way, Michael Lewis will be on our show tomorrow, talk about his ideas on this. But today we are talking with John Cassidy, staff writer for The New Yorker. His article, No Credit, appears in the March 15th issue. And Joshua Green is a senior editor at The Atlantic. His article, Timothy Geithner, Inside Man, appears in the April issue of The Atlantic. Stay with us for more. We're talking about Timothy Geithner's performance over the first 15 months of the Obama administration with Joshua Green, senior editor of The Atlantic. His article, Timothy Geithner, Inside Man, appears in the April issue. John Cassidy's article on him is in The New Yorker's March 15th issue. It's called No Credit. Today, Senator Dodd is finally going to put out some kind of proposal for reform. Wouldn't passing reform sooner rather than later have helped? Because we keep on talking about all the problems, but nobody's ever said, well, here are a couple of solutions.
I think it probably would have. You know, had Obama come right into office and cracked down on the banks, I think he would have had a chance to build some credibility that might have inoculated him against some of the problems Geithner's had with AIG and the others. And might even have helped with health care reform and some other things where the administration has kind of come under fire for, you know, cutting deals with special interests and that sort of thing. But I tend to actually defend them on this one. I think that, you know, when Obama came in, there were a number of very big things he wanted to get done. He opted to go for health care and energy before financial reform. I think that made financial reform more difficult, but I think it's a defensible choice to have made, especially if we do wind up getting some form of health reform, which we're now told we should know by the end of the week.
I've always argued that this was a terrible strategic error by the Obama administration. I think that given that the scale of the economic crisis, they should have made the economy and the financial system the first job won for an entire first year. Now, that would have involved pirouetting on the campaign about healthcare, etc. But I think the economic situation was so dire, and they've actually done such a reasonable job of it, that if they'd have had the stimulus package, some sort of economic recovery, plus some sort of financial services reform bill, they could have pointed to that, said, look, we've done the job, now let's turn to health care.
They could have linked it all as well and
exactly.
Talked about how they all were part of the same process.
Exactly. It gives you a narrative for the administration, which they've lost because they've spent all their time on health care. And, you know, financial reform is very complicated, and there are lots of arguments for taking it slowly, but there were a couple of quick things they could have done, I think, which they could have got through in the early months while they had the initiative.
Josh, Timothy Geithner has seemed more concerned than National Economic Council Chair Lawrence Summers about the possibility of spooking investors. Why has Geithner put such a premium on investors' perceptions of the strength of the market?
Well, one of the novel things that Geithner and the economic team came up with in their plan was how they decided to recapitalize banks. And when you're recovering from a financial crisis, one of the things you need to do is recapitalize banks so that they can absorb losses, so that they can continue to lend. And traditionally, if you look at the history of financial crises, it tends to be the government that puts in that money, taxpayers. Geithner's idea that he came up with, I think in December, was that, you know, there was a way to do this feasibly where the private market could come in, private investors could recapitalize these banks. And if they were able to make that happen, the bill for the taxpayer would be a lot lower than it ordinarily would. Cleveland Fed has done a study of recent financial crises that said generally they cost taxpayers about 5 to 10% of GDP, which would be somewhere between $750 billion and $1.5 trillion. You know, Geithner's plan was successful in attracting a lot of private capital. I think to date, About $140 billion in private money has come in, whereas the government has put in about $7 billion toward banks in the Obama administration. So in that sense, in sort of a strict dollars and cents sense, it's been successful. The problem is, if you're counting on private investors to put that money in, you have to tread very carefully. And one of the things Geithner has been militant about, it's been terrible politically, is to not spook the markets by coming in and administering what Geithner refers to as Old Testament justice, firing CEOs and doing the kind of populist things that would be good politics.
Well, how important is investor confidence in this financial crisis? The stock market seems to be rolling along.
Yeah, I mean, I think you've got to think back a bit, Leonard. Now things look great, but this time last year, you know, the Dow Jones Industrial Average was down at 6,500, actually dropped under it for a while. The credit markets were still in bad shape. It was hard for banks to lend to each other, never mind to lend to the public. So, yeah, in retrospect, it looks like he could have been a lot tougher on the markets. I think he should have been rhetorically tougher in a lot of areas. But there was a sort of underlying economic logic that they were working on, as Josh points out.
Well, listeners have been writing in. I'm just going to read the questions as they've come in, even though they don't necessarily follow up to what we've been talking about. One caller is interested in how derivatives are being marked to market on the bank's balance sheets. Are losses being hidden still?
I could take that. I mean, I don't know about derivatives specifically. The mark-to-market rules got relaxed last year by the accounting board, which has allowed them to not mark down some of their mortgage assets. Derivatives have always been mark-to-market because they trade it. They generally trade in a market, so there is a market price you can apply to them. So I don't think it's not that they're hiding big derivatives losses. If they're hiding any losses, they're hiding them on their bank books where they keep all their real estate assets.
Josh, a listener on the Upper East Side asks, any mention of getting help for Timothy Geithner? His department was severely understaffed, from what I remember, due to nominations that were held up, and I haven't heard any news about that since.
You know, they've since moved ahead on a couple of confirmations, but it really is just a remarkable story that 15 months into the Obama administration, not just the Treasury, but a lot of administrations are still lacking all sorts of people in senior positions. So Geithner has managed to do all this short-staffed and still needs more help, I think.
Another listener says, in not firing people, hasn't that left much of the Wall Street status quo intact? Aren't they the people who got us into this mess in the first place?
I think that's correct to an extent. I mean, you haven't seen, you know, major changes. I mean, I think the administration would argue, and Larry Summers argued to me, that, if you take a look at the financial landscape and the big CEOs who were in place while this crisis happened, you know, the Stan O'Neills, the Chuck Princes, you know, they're gone. You know, Dick Fuld, gone. You know, all these people have kind of been vilified to an extent. I'm only somewhat persuaded by that argument.
My guests are two people who have written articles recently about Timothy Geithner. Joshua Green, senior editor at The Atlantic. His article, Timothy Geithner, Inside Man, appears in the April issue. John Cassidy is a staff writer for The New Yorker. His article, No Credit, appears in the March 15th issue. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. What role has former Federal Reserve Chairman Paul Volcker played in the administration's response to the economy? It's my sense that they roll him out whenever they want to get a little bit of credibility and then just ignore him after that.
Yeah, I mean, I suspect you're right there, Leonard. I mean, I think the treatment of Volcker has been bad, and I think Geithner does bear some responsibility for this. I mean, we haven't really talked about the sort of extent of the financial re-regulation that they're proposing. Geithner is obviously a centrist technocrat, and he's adopted a lot of sort of sensible policies, but he did resist for a long time Volcker's idea to stop banks like Goldman Sachs and Morgan Stanley from having access to the discount window. That means they can lend from the Federal Reserve, which was introduced during the crisis.
He wanted to bar banks from investing in hedge funds equity funds.
Well, exactly. So and from proprietary trading. So if a firm like Goldman Sachs or Morgan Stanley wants to carry on doing that, they're going to have to give up their banking license so that they can't then lend from the Fed. That's a very sensible policy, not particularly controversial, I don't think. Volcker's been on his high horse about it for a year. And for some reason, Geithner just didn't adopt it until the White House forced him to adopt it late in the year. Now a lot of people think that he's backing away from it again.
I would criticize him on that count.
Josh, you mentioned earlier that everybody thinks Geithner worked for Goldman Sachs, but he did work for Kissinger Associates. How did the private sector open doors for him? Have Kissinger or Pete Peterson come to his defense?
Yeah, I think, I mean, Geithner, after he went to graduate school at Johns Hopkins, his first job was working for Kissinger Associates, which is the consulting firm that was founded by Henry Kissinger and Lawrence Eagleburger. This would have been when Geithner was in his mid-20s, and it was for 3 years. And his job there basically was to kind of follow Asia and then brief Kissinger and Eagleburger on what was happening. So functionally, he had the job of a high-level political aide to some of the world's most powerful people. And what's interesting about Geithner as a character is that that seems to have been his thing all along. I mean, he has a real skill for winning the trust and support of very, very powerful people, and he has since his days at Kissinger Associates. And he went on from there to the Clinton Treasury, where he became a protege of Larry Summers and then Bob Rubin, and really today, having become Obama's right-hand man on the economy.
And John Geithner has been unwilling to distance himself from former colleagues who've made mistakes, like Bob Rubin, after he returned to Wall Street to run Citibank. Has that hurt him?
Well, it's obviously hurt him. I mean, I'd refer to the title of Josh's piece, which is brilliant, really, Inside Man. This is what this guy is. He's always worked inside the system, cultivating, as Josh says, powerful people. So that has sort of two aspects to it. Number one, it means he knows how the system works very well. He knows how the financial markets well. He knows the key players. So he's actually quite effective at getting things done on an inside level. And as I said, in economic terms, you can make good arguments for a lot of what he's done. Politically, in the current atmosphere where we've got an anti-establishment sort of populist wave sweeping the country, it means he gets attacked from right and left. And, it ties the Obama administration to a sort of, establishment perception.
Josh Geithner worked on the response to the Mexican crisis in 1994 and then the string of Asian crises that followed. What did that period teach him about the role that government can play or should play in responding to a financial crisis?
Well, if you look at Geithner's career in hindsight, I mean, it looks uncannily like a series of tests that were meant to kind of prepare him for this big crisis in the fall of 2008. He worked on Treasury's international response team to the series of emerging market crises that began in Mexico in 1995 and kind of swept through Asia, Thailand, Korea, even Russia. And what Geithner learned was that there are a series of steps that you have to take if you're a government to contain these crises, to stop them, and to recover from them. And the one big lesson above all that Geithner learned was that governments move too slowly, that because the politics of responding to a crisis are so galling to the public, having to inject billions and billions of dollars into the same banks that have caused all the pain, that governments shy away. And the example of that Geithner would give would be Japan in the 1990s and its lost decade, where the Japanese government just refused to deal with the banking crisis. So Geithner's own view of what he's done in response to this crisis, I think, has been that the United States avoided those mistakes, and that as painful as it is in a political sense to have to absorb all this abuse, what they've done in a policy sense has been the right thing, and that in the long term, that's what's best for the country, that's what's best for voters, even if the Democratic Party, Obama, and possibly even Geithner himself are going to have to pay a steep political price for this at the polls.
John, as early as 2004, Timothy Geithner realized the risk inherent in trading derivatives and publicly said that the increasing use and reliance on them was a problem. Why didn't he do more to curb them then?
It's a very good question. I mean, I covered Geithner when he was president of the New York Federal Reserve, which basically oversees Wall Street. And at the time, he used to make some interesting speeches, as you said, which sort of differed from the Alan Greenspan line, which was that the banks can regulate themselves and we can rely on self-interest to prevent a blow-up. So that's to Geithner's credit. The hit on Geithner is that he was head of the New York Fed, which is the chief regulator for all these banks. So at the same time he was making these good speeches about how we should toughen up various regulations, he wasn't catching what the banks were doing, which eventually blew up the entire system. So, he was a good talker, but he wasn't a great regulator.
The European Union is currently working out new regulations on hedge funds that Geithner feels would discriminate against U.S. firms. Hasn't Paul Volcker advocated similar regulations here?
That's the problem with that's the political problem with Geithner. He again seems to be defending powerful interests here. U.S. hedge funds. I think the argument he's making is that if the U.S. introduces some restrictions on hedge funds, such as the Volcker rules, such as forcing them to register, then Europe has to do the same thing, because if there isn't a level playing field, the hedge funds will just move to the area where they're less regulated. So it's actually a sound argument, but again, the sort of optics of it, as they say in Washington, are problematic.
Josh, you mentioned earlier that Senator Chris Dodd is expected to unveil the latest version of the financial reform bill this afternoon, and it's expected to expand the powers of the Federal Reserve and the Treasury. Is the effort to pass financial reform really going to move forward now, do you think? You're in Washington.
You know, I think it'll move forward. I think what, you know, as we discussed earlier, the reforms that are likely to pass are just much, much weaker than, you know, what any reasonable person would have expected or wanted a year ago. That's partly because so much time has passed, and sort of ironically or perversely, because the economy has recovered so well, you know, the public desire for reform has kind of bled away a little bit. But it's also because if you look at who is actually in charge of reform, I mean, Geithner and Larry Summers wrote the administration's reform plan, which was taken up by the House of Representatives. And it was also sort of the basis, I think, for Dodd's own plan. You know, these are reforms that are written by, you know, financial insiders, and, you know, folks like Dodd have been, you know, very tight with all these big banks and insurance companies for years and years and years. And so what's likely to emerge, and I think something will have to emerge for political reasons for the administration, might sound good, and you often hear the line that it's going to be the biggest financial reform since the New Deal. But it's really sort of disappointing in the sense that it's not nearly as strong as what it could have been.
John, at the end of your piece, you quote Geithner saying, "Why do policymakers screw up financial crises? They screw up financial crises because the politics are horrible, and that deters action." Isn't that what we're seeing right now in Washington?
Well,
a lot of horse trading.
Yeah, you're right. I mean, what Geithner's referring to there is what Josh referred to a few minutes ago, taking action early in a banking crisis by injecting public money, which is what Bush administration did in the fall of 2008, and it's what Obama went along with rather than reneging on that deal. That was the sort of sin which they're still paying the political price. But what's happened on the financial reform thing is, of course, it's all got bogged down. There's been an enormous lobbying effort in Washington. Banks have spent tens and tens of millions of dollars, hundreds of millions of dollars, to clog this up in Congress on the Democratic side and the Republican side. So what we're getting is the sort of, you know, lowest common denominator, what can be put through. So there are some worthwhile reforms, but as Josh said, they're not going to be revolutionary.
And Josh, you say that Geithner could end up being Obama's most influential advisor.
Well, I think so. I mean, if you believe, as most people in Washington believe, that the economy is what's ultimately going to determine, you know, Obama and the Democrats' success or failure, and you look back at the first year and say, you know, who is most influential in terms of coming up with this plan that the president's followed, the answer is Tim Geithner. And, you know, Geithner doesn't have the kind of larger-than-life persona that Larry Summers, that some other people do. But, you know, he's a behind-the-scenes operator, as he has been throughout his career. He's clearly influenced the president. We can argue about whether he's done so for better or for worse. But I think that he's been the key guy in the first year of the administration on the economy and in the financial reform front.
Well, the New York Times Magazine would suggest it was Rahm Emanuel, but, well, they're not the Atlantic or the New Yorker, are they? And I want to thank the two of you so much for being with us. Joshua Green is senior editor of the Atlantic. His article, Timothy Geithner, Inside Man, appears in the April issue. John Cassidy is a staff writer for the New Yorker. His article, No Credit, appears in the March 15th issue. Thank you both so much for being with us today.
Thanks very much.
Great to be with you guys.